Where is this big recession that everybody keeps calling for? Has the Fed actually pulled off a soft landing? Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. In today's global macroeconomic update, we will discuss the strong US economy, interest rates, we'll look at bond volatility, Bitcoin's price and its current consolidation, our thoughts on the US election, and most importantly, we will get into, with regard to this particular topic, why we still believe that a US economic slowdown is ahead and some of the risks to that outlook. All right, we have the TBL research team today. Augustine has a bunch of questions for me. He's pulled some charts and we're going to walk through his main theme, which is where is this recession that everyone keeps calling for? Including the Bitcoin layer, we have had a negative outlook on the economy, but we want to really unpack that and explain, be transparent, why we've been negative on the economy. Where is the recession? It's definitely not here. We've tried to explain to you guys that even though we have a recessionary outlook, the spot economy is strong. GDP is strong. The consumer is still doing well. So his theme today is, where is the recession? Do we still have a recessionary outlook? And let's start with this first chart on inflation versus unemployment. And Augustine is basically asking here that unemployment has been kept low while inflation has been kept low. Are we in a Goldilocks scenario? And has Jerome Powell basically succeeded at a soft landing? Now, I don't believe Jerome Powell has succeeded at the soft landing yet. And let me explain why. It basically has to do with the reason why I still have a negative outlook on the economy. And that is the lagged effects of tight policy. Higher interest rates take time. And this is really about time. If we have a policy rate that goes up, and I want to mention something in the background here before we really get into this. One of our big blind spots was how much influence the large deficit would have on the economy. So we then inherited that into our framework. And we credit Lynn Alden for being the most vocal on fiscal dominance back then in 2022. The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by Unchained, the undisputed leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults in which you own two of three keys and you gain a Bitcoin security partner. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage via Unchained's trading desk and eliminate all exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, where you can convert your existing 401ks or retirement accounts to Unchained, all while keeping control of your Bitcoin private keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to Unchained today. Go to unchained.com/TBL for $100 off when you sign up. Don't risk your Bitcoin security. Do you have Bitcoin private keys stored on paper? Make sure you convert those keys to titanium with Stampseed. Stampseed has this really cool DIY kit that allows you to hammer in your seed phrase into these small titanium plates that are fire resistant and damage resistant. This kit is designed by titanium metal workers that have been working in stamping metal for over 14 years, and your words are deeply stamped, not just a shallow dot. So make sure you check out stampseed.com today and use code TBL for 15% off of your order. So we learned a lot from Lynn. We learned our lesson. We understood the influence, the sheer influence of a large fiscal deficit today and how it can basically prevent economic slowdown by the sheer volume of stimulus coming out of the fiscal side of the equation. And it doesn't even have to be explicit stimulus. It just has to be deficits. Because when the deficits happen, treasury bills get issued. And now we're getting more into the liquidity framework side of things, our TBL liquidity framework side of things. When we get into bill issuance, where do those bills get housed? They get housed in the commercial banking sector, which is balance sheet expansion, because when the bills are issued, the liability side of the bank is a deposit at the government contractors, issued to the government contractor who has an asset, a deposit at a bank. The bank issues a deposit liability and buys a T-bill on the other side for the asset and expands its balance sheet. So the whole system grows when bills hit the system. And this isn't how every bill hits the system. However, at the margin, this is what is happening. And so when we understood Lynn Alden's fiscal dominance thesis that, hey, the deficits themselves are correlated to higher nominal GDP, you have to factor in basically, and she, the reason that she was able to do that, history. So we didn't have enough history we were bringing to the framework. So you understand the influence of these large deficits. And that is where we live now. We live in the trillions and trillions of dollars of deficits on a cumulative basis. So $10 trillion in cumulative deficits for the five post-COVID years. Now, let's bring it back. We have the fiscal influence on one side. We have the monetary influence on the other. Both are going to affect the economy, which has a life of its own as well. Now, if we have a massive wave of inflation, 2021, 2022, then you get a wave of monetary tightening, 22 and 23. The linear activity, and remember that when we say linear, what we mean is that A causes B. And we know that we live in a complex world, so it's not just A causes B. You have A through Z causing A through Z. So you have all these things happening at the same time. But part of being a researcher is you have to isolate one effect, one input on each output, and in that way, try to build a framework for understanding how so many things can interact at the same time. So you have the monetary tightening, and you would expect on a linear basis that to cause an economic slowdown on a 12 to 24 month lag. Why? Because history, the empirical data tells us that when we get a tightening of policy rates and an inversion of the yield curve, it precedes an economic slowdown and or recession almost every single time because of those lagged effects of tighter monetary policy. But we haven't gotten one yet. And so you have to look for answers. And we've been looking for them for 2 years. And so even though we've had a negative outlook on the economy, because why? We understand the lagged effects of monetary policy. We'll get into that. I promise you, there's so much more to unpack. But when you have a negative forward expectation based off of the lagged effects of monetary policy, that is based in empirical data, you can look at the economy and say, hey, it's not happening yet, so look for the reasons why. Well, a couple years ago, we found one of the main reasons. It's this fiscal dominance, the fiscal influence of deficits, and then we took it and combined it with our own liquidity framework, which understands asset-side liquidity and the expansion of the banking system to account for all these T-bills, which account for all the deficit. So then we made it make sense to us that the system is expanding, there's more money to go around, and that is preventing any economic slowdown that might have happened with higher interest rates. I don't necessarily buy into the interest income channel supporting larger nominal GDP growth and that having a stimulative effect, but there's credence to that as well. So the whole component here of the fiscal side of the equation cannot be ignored. And if we're looking for reasons why we haven't received a recession or really even flirted with one over the last year, even though rates went up by 5% on the policy side, you can point your fingers at the fiscal side of the equation and the deficits there supporting the economy. You can also really just point to the consumer being in a good place, being able to withstand higher interest rates because the level of indebtedness is not high enough. So let's look at the chart of delinquencies. What we see here is we're in rising delinquencies, means people are missing payments across credit cards, autos, and their homes. They're doing so at alarming rates, but still the economy is showing real GDP growth and avoiding a recession on the aggregate level. So it is confusing to a lot of people that why is there all this really bad recessionary data, recessionary indicators, but we don't seem to get one. That's the source of the confusion. It is the inspiration behind a lot of Augustine's questions today and how we're getting into the numbers and what he's presenting, because he's just pulling the data and showing us, look at the economy, look at where it is. On a spot level, there is no sign of a recession. Now, to get back to the monetary side of things, interest rates going up is going to make delinquencies worse or better by itself on a linear basis. Definitely worse, because even if just a small portion of those people have variable interest rates, which many of the non-mortgage sector does have variable interest rates, they're going to have more expensive payments. More expensive payments either leads to missed payments or lower consumption elsewhere. For all of those reasons, the consumer should be slowing. We should be seeing rising delinquencies, but it's not getting into the GDP growth going negative, which is how we classify a recession. And recession really has such a broad and vague definition these days, but take it from us, we're not really waiting for any economic body to tell us we're in a recession. The recession is going to come basically from one, you will know it. It is happening when one thing happens. And that one thing that will happen that will tell us we are in a recession is the fiscal package. So how long has it been since you heard the phrase fiscal package? Years, really the post-pandemic response. The fiscal package that happened several years ago, that was in response to the sudden contraction in the economy and the U.S. government wanting to restart the economic engine. And the next time you get the fiscal package, it will be to address spiking unemployment and a real genuine slowdown in the economy that needs some sort of kickstart. And we know that the kickstart that the economy will get will not come from a post-deflationary bust. Why? Because that is politically unrealistic. It doesn't matter who is the president. It doesn't matter who is in Congress. The response to a sharp economic slowdown will be fiscal stimulus. It will also be monetary stimulus, but that's not really what we're talking about here. The Fed has already started to cut rates, okay? So the Fed is either ahead of the game on a recession, sees a recession coming. It's basically that the Fed sees a recession potentially coming, needs to get out in front of it. It cannot risk being too restrictive. It has to cut rates. But what is the government doing? The government is not doing anything from a legislative perspective, from a fiscal stimulus legislative perspective. The government is not doing anything. We're in the middle of an election. And so not until 2025 would you even have the prospect of something coming together. But the recession has to come, meaning people have to get fired in such a large wave that it warrants people calling their representatives and it actually getting, hey, we need help. You need to restart the economy. Local officials calling federal officials, people calling their representatives in government saying, we need some assistance. And the reason that the constituents do that is because they know they're going to get a fiscal package. I'm not even going to call it a handout because it's not a handout. That is how the U.S. government fiscal system works. The entire thing is a distribution of funds to the private sector and, of course, to government employees. But the private sector is the administrator of so much of the government funds that the handout, the quote-unquote handout, it's not a handout. It's just the distribution of funds. They'll increase the distribution of funds. They'll redistribute the funds to different outputs. But that is the response that we will get every time. This show is not here to debate whether or not that's the right thing for the U.S. to do. We'll talk about that on a different program. But today what we're trying to understand is why hasn't there been a recession? Not what is the political reason that bailouts are always the thing or that fiscal packages are always the response. Fiscal packages are the response until we don't see it. That's a different conversation, why or when they should not be, or how Bitcoin even addresses the notion that those packages can just be handed out crisis after crisis, time and time again. Those are much greater philosophical conversations that we have and will continue to have. But talking about the recession and why it hasn't come yet, and the fiscal influence on the economy, the lagged effects of monetary policy, putting all of those things together, you still are going to have, in our opinion, a negative outlook for interest rate sensitive sectors. Why? Because the policy rates right now are at a point that make the marginal project unprofitable. So you want to talk about linear and connecting A to B? Let's do it all the way to the end to show you why I am not budging on my negative economic outlook. I'll show you the risk to it at the end. But this is why I have the outlook. Despite a huge fiscal package that came in 2021, 2020, 21, 22, and is still having impact today, especially through high deficits themselves. Despite all of that, the next large fiscal package is where? Nowhere to be found. Why? No constituent calling and begging for one. So that package, it will lose its momentum eventually. So the momentum that brought, it will fade. So then you have a fading influence of that stimulus. The prospect of a new one, in my opinion, is basically zero. Well, I shouldn't say zero because politics can change and you can see things happen that are unforeseen. But I'm going with the assumption that the next large multi-trillion dollar fiscal package, which probably will happen, won't happen until things get really bad. So we have to rule that out as a source of nominal GDP growth. So you have a fading fiscal influence. Then you have the monetary influence, higher rates. Higher rates are stopping the marginal project from happening. So a real estate developer that looks in the Sun Belt at the inventory of housing looks at a plot of land and says, how much will it cost to build a building or 100 homes? What's the carry cost? What are the either the rental prices that I will generate or the home prices that I will be able to sell these properties for? And once you do the math, you either green light or you red light the project. Right now, I promise you that in many parts of the country, the project is red lighted. It's not happening. It's not going forward. We've talked about that with a few guests here on the program. The marginal housing project is being stalled because of the existing projects that are facing a slowdown. So the housing market is in a slowdown because it's an interest rate sensitive sector. Do I feel that there's just a sudden rebound in that whole part of the United States that's really suffering from an inventory spike? No, I don't. That's not in my base case. So we're going with my opinion and what I believe is going to happen. So I'm laying it out for you guys. So now we have a housing sector that is slowing. It's interest rate sensitive. So the slowdown of the housing sector is forward looking. Now, if that developer doesn't decide to build, who doesn't get the next job? Every worker and every materials provider. And then that new house isn't formed, so every furniture purchase, service purchase, and all that household formation energy from the that side of the economic engine also starts to stall. So the idea that housing has an outsized influence on the U.S. economy and that that will be a source of the economic slowdown because of higher interest rates and the lagged effects of interest rate hikes of 5%, it's not some crazy theory. It's actually a very basic outlook, in my opinion. And I understand that it might sound crazy if you're pointing to the spot GDP. And that's what we're doing here is we're saying, hey, look at GDP. It isn't reflecting anything that you're talking about. Where is this slowdown? You're crazy. You're not seeing what is happening today. Well, I am, and I'm not claiming that we're in a recession. I'm definitely not claiming that. And what's my guiding light there? ISM services. Manufacturing has been in a recession for quite a while, a couple years in and out of recession. But services are strong. They've dipped. They've had trouble. It's had trouble. Employment is slowing. And I understand I have so many more charts for you, but I want to explain why I still believe that a slowdown is a basic economic outlook here, just using what I've learned in my time in markets. So let's get now to the housing sector, the household formation slowing down. Then what happens after that type of slowdown? Certain parts of the economy have lower employment. Now, if employment goes down, meaning people lose their jobs, and they're not able to secure enough unemployment assistance, what will go next? The consumer. Because if the consumer loses his or her job, the consumer is unable to spend. And then what happens to 2/3 of the economy? It slows. So again, if you go all the way on a linear basis, I hope that you see that it's easy to forecast one based off of the basics of lagged effects of monetary policy. Now, I can already hear the counter, which is that, well, what if they lower rates so quickly or quickly enough that you take the interest rate sensitive sector and you give it the boost that it needed and you save it and you save the day? Maybe that can happen, but the Fed, in my opinion, would have to cut a lot quicker and steeper than this little 25 versus 50 debate every few weeks, which I don't think the 25 versus 50 debate will last forever. Eventually, the data, I believe, will slow enough that the Fed has to really get below 3.5. I don't think it can do so 25 at a time. I just don't. And so if you bring back the inverted yield curve too that we had, and a yield curve today that is modestly steepening, but not that steep, it means that investors, even though they have a similar yield between twos and tens, they're still willing to hang out in tens because they feel that 4% over a 10-year time horizon is a good rate. And if economic growth was really, and we know that inflation is near 4% anyway, so it's not really that much of a reward. Only if the curve was much steeper would I be saying that, hey, the recession isn't really here. There's no recession. The curve is steep. The future growth expectations are high. But the curve is still flat. I know it's uninverted. Hooray. But it's still flat. It's basically still close to zero. It means that there is no 2 to 10 year forward growth expectation, that growth expectation is flat. And so those are all the reasons I just believe that the economy is still facing restriction, like interest rate restriction is what it's facing, and that will have a lagged effect. So hopefully, and I'm going to get into all these charts and these questions, but now hopefully you have an idea of my framework into why, first of all, why a recession hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened because you haven't had the hit to consumer, because you haven't had enough of a hit to unemployment, because you haven't had enough of a hit to companies. And so companies broadly will only get into firing people when they have to make the margin, when there's some marginal slowdown in consumption, which can come without a huge slowdown in the real estate sector. And so that marginal slowdown in consumption, which would trigger a huge corporate wave of firing people, which would then trigger a wave of slowdown of consumption, which would definitely put us in recession and into that fiscal package zone that I've been talking about. That marginal slowdown hasn't happened, which is why the recession hasn't happened. There haven't been enough companies that have faced the pressure for mass layoffs to trigger that wave. But if you wait long enough for the economy to, not even the economy, if you wait long enough for the housing sector to absorb that higher interest rate, which directly impacts margins, projects, and it then causes this slowdown in which you start to get a build in inventory, and then only with a massive build in inventory can you actually see prices come down. They are still going up on a nationwide basis. So that lag, it just hasn't happened yet. And that's how we have to think about this lagged effect, why I still have a negative outlook on the economy, and why a recession just hasn't happened yet. Because the trigger hasn't, it just hasn't occurred. But the fact that it hasn't occurred doesn't impact the way that I look at the forward economy based off of the data I have available. Also based on the path of interest rates, based off of the yield curve. A ton of information in the yield curve. If you guys want to get more into the yield curve and what we do at the Bitcoin Layer and our research framework, go subscribe to thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. Become a TBL pro. Get all of our research. Every Monday, we put out this really great risk report, mean, median, mode, and we're able to deliver a lot of quantitative insights across interest rates, risk markets, and Bitcoin. Now, one more question here before we get to the next chart is, should we be worried about an uptick in inflation? The answer is yes. Inflation hasn't been killed. And the fact that we just have discussed that the marginal consumer is still buying today, that means that inflation can't die. Inflation can only die when price cuts happen, right? I mean, that's what it means. To have prices go down would be to kill inflation. Why would prices go down when the company can't find the consumer? So you can't fully kill inflation until you've killed the consumer. The Fed hasn't killed the consumer. I know it's cutting because it sees a slowdown on the horizon. It sees higher unemployment on the horizon. So it means consumer will slow going forward in the Fed's eyes. That's why it is cutting already. But is there a worry about an uptick in inflation? Of course, because we're not in a recession. So you haven't killed inflation. Am I worried about an uptick beyond 4%? Definitely not without that next fiscal package as we've discussed. So when you want to think about the US election, US politics, the way that the House and the Senate will go, whether the Trump presidency will have a red Senate and House, or a Harris presidency will have a blue House, still probably a red Senate, how all of those things will impact fiscal policy and what bills might get passed in any slowdown or recession, all of that stuff, it does matter and it can't be ignored. But without a big fiscal package, am I worried about inflation going above 4%? Not really. Now, what happens from 3.3 to 3.5 to 3.7%? That's probably not a chat for today, but we will consider what that would mean for the path of policy rates and the path for asset prices. On this next chart, we overlay yields and the dollar. The dollar has gotten strong. The question here is, why are higher rates higher demand for the dollar? Is it people selling treasuries, so the cash of those treasuries goes to be reinvested in dollars? And I would say that that is not the dynamic that I believe is happening. As rates go up, it's basically the marginal investor stepping away and saying, I'm not going to bid there. So rates just drift up until they find the buyer. And they find buyers as yields go up, and it brings investors out of other currencies and into the dollar. So the dollar going up right now, a little bit of just a pure interest rate parity trade, currency flows following the higher interest rates, and the higher dollar is a danger for the global economy. Nobody wants the higher dollar, which is part of the reason we believe the Fed is trying to lower rates in the first place, because the whole world is cutting. So if the Fed doesn't cut, the dollar will strengthen on interest rate parity. So we're looking at the dollar and the way that the dollar has moved higher, it is definitely warrants us watching it. Bond volatility has gone up of late, and that is because rates have gone up. There is I believe there is a Trump trade going on with selling treasuries, buying stocks right now on a bit of a higher growth expectation and a lower tax outlook for the United States. But also, rates rallied so hard that a little bit of a sell-off and a consolidation in treasuries and the dollar, which had declined quite a bit in the dollars when yields fell throughout the summer, that consolidation is well within context. Let's pull up a chart on tens. Okay, here we have this chart on tens, and what you see, of course, is the breakdown of yields below the trend line, the ascending trend line in treasury yields as we had an inflation wave and a selling of this 10-year fixed asset. Then we saw buyers finally come back around 5%. Why? There was value there. That's really all you can deduce from this, is that if buyers come back, there was value. There continues to be value at 5% because yields are at 4%. But at 3.5%, it ran into a bit of a hurdle, and we see yields trading back up to 4%. Now, I believe that the 4.25, 4.33 level that we broke down below, that was a huge level. To think that we would retest that is well within context of all of my experience in market, being a market technician. And when you have a big break and you go higher or lower, you have a retest. So yields all the way down to 3.5, come back, retest 4.25, and really see, do the buyers have conviction? Are they going to come in and purchase 10-year treasuries at 4.25? Our bias would be yes. It would hold with this lower growth outlook. And if you see yields go above 4.25, 4.33, you can basically put our negative growth outlook and you can say it's wrong. And that is why we say price is truth. Because the price tells me what the growth expectation is. And if 4.25, 4.33 fails and we go up to 4.5% and we go to 5%, guess what? There is no recession being priced into 10-year treasuries. So you'll stop hearing me talk about it. And in that case, you'll probably have a pretty steep yield curve. So you won't hear me talking about it. Until then, we'll let price dictate. And so below 4.25, lower growth outlook is intact. My framework is heavily markets driven. Some people might struggle with that. Sometimes for the pros, I'll do posts. I will not mention the Fed a single time. I will not mention a single economic indicator. We'll go pure prices, pure candlesticks. And I don't have a bunch of economic indicators, you know, all the bands, all the moving averages. I look at them for sure, but they don't dominate my framework. I look at just lines, meaning horizontal lines and trend lines to tell me where the buyers and sellers are clustered. So I'm looking for behavior in the market. Where are the buyers? Where are the sellers? That's it. All the little technical indicators, their goal is to try to sift through the price behavior and tell the trader, hey, bullish or bearish. But I don't use all of that. I just use my eyes. I'm not even joking with you. I just use my eyes. I look at the levels and I just see the behavior on the chart. What do I see on this chart? I see a lower growth outlook as of 2023. And I see a retest in working itself right now. And if that retest is purchased, the lower growth outlook will stay intact. And if it isn't, we'll have to adjust it. And that is what an honest framework does. It has to readjust. Why did I go looking for why I was wrong in 2022? Because rates went up, not down. And so you have to look at price and let it guide you so that you're not just looking at for a narrative. Have a narrative, but have the price guide you as to whether or not your narrative is right or wrong. And you can absolutely rely on us to do that. We can't get it right every time. Who could? If we would, we'd be trading it, not doing YouTube videos. Okay? So our job is to give you research. My job personally is to teach you what I know so that you can do it yourself to the best of your ability. And I know for a fact, because I was on the desk, that the type of information that I relay to you that I learned from my career is not necessarily publicly available. So thank God there are some people out there that are teaching alongside me that you guys are learning from, and I hope to be one of those people for you. Okay, this next chart gets back into the heart of our framework, TBL liquidity. And if you want to learn more about TBL liquidity, go download our new report, Understanding What Moves Bitcoin. And we co-presented that with Unchained so that you guys understand this TBL liquidity framework and how we've built it out. Well, one of the big influencers of liquidity from our perspective and our index, which we are transparent about what is in it, we show you in our report exactly what's in the index. A big part of it is bond volatility. Why? Because as an asset-based model, the assets give the banks power to create money. And the banks have more power to create when vol is low, and they have less power to create when vol is high. Right now, vol is spiking. So Augustine asks that we had a huge move up in the move index, which represents bond volatility, but the S&P did not decline as much this time, despite the huge uptick. So why? And he's asking, is it the election? Yes, in part, I believe that there's an election trade going on right now. I believe Trump is getting priced in. I already have gone on record into saying that I believe the prediction markets have basically given him Pennsylvania, which is the only state he needs from my own counting of the map. So I believe that there's a Trump trade in the market. Now, why the spike in bond volatility? And I want to show, to answer that, I want to show another chart here. We'll come back to this move chart. Okay, now in this chart, S&P and the 10-year yield, you can see something here that is a big signal. Now, if you look on the right-hand side, you have the S&P 500 axis, bottom to top in a normal way, and that's the orange line of the S&P. Then on the other side, you have the 10-year yield, but the axis is inverted. Now, why do we do that at the Bitcoin layer? Why do we present it like this? Because for the last few years, the trade has been higher yields are dangerous to stocks and lower yields are good for stocks. So that's why as yields go down, stocks go up. But what has happened? Yields have gone up and stocks have gone up. So correlation is shifting. This is one of those regime shifts. And when do regime shifts and correlations happen? When something material happens in the market that affects buyer behavior, market behavior. It's all about behavior, guys. So what is the trade? Sell the 10-year and buy stocks. Why? Higher forward growth. I know we've just talked about my forward recession outlook, but this is forward growth, way forward, that we are going to sell our risk off asset and we are going to buy the risk on asset. So this is a sign that interest rates themselves have lost the influence on risk markets. I have pointed this out over the last few weeks here. This is a high signal chart. And it now let's go back to the other chart. So now you see the gray bars are this representing the spike in weekly change in volatility. Spike, 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 but what's happening to stocks? Up. The liquidity wave that we believe we are about to see from the monetary side of things, so forward-looking bond volatility, the ability for banks to create money forward, that fiscal package that I talked about, and lower policy rates, and uninverting the curve. That is a huge one, uninverting the curve, because that relieves pressure on the financial system, which makes them more able to make markets, which will reduce vol. Because vol is reduced when market makers make markets. Why? Because people want to buy vol. They want to buy protection. Forget buy vol. You guys might not understand vol, so let's just talk about insurance. Do people want to buy insurance to protect themselves? Yes. That's why there's an insurance industry. So that industry in the financial markets are the market makers. So when people want protection, what do they buy? They buy options. Who sells them? The market makers. How are the market makers going to sell options when they're confident about the way things are going and the curve is set up in a way that's not punitive to them to go get funding? Or are they going to, and the answer is that market makers will make markets when rates are low, and especially when their carry is positive, it means repo rates are below what the instruments that they want to house on inventory yield. I believe all of that is at play for liquidity expansion in the TBL liquidity sense of the word. Now, careful with the liquidity indices that you see out there. They all have different stuff in them. So if you want one that is transparent and that we're showing you how it works, and we believe it's actually advanced because it's not a liability-based number. It's much more money creation-oriented. So we believe that expansion is there, but even though MOVE is a big part, and MOVE, and now let's go to our TBL liquidity to show you what it looks like, a big drop here in purple. Liquidity is down. But guess what? Stocks are not following it yet. Now, my thoughts here are that probably at times, the bond volatility component to our index is too pronounced. It's too dominant. And so it's chopping our index around too much. But we will be looking at that because, of course, we're refining this all the time and trying to get it to be a better signal for you guys as well as for us. But I believe that this drop in liquidity, which is influenced by a spike in bond volatility, will unwind as the protection that the demand for protection that came into the market over the last 3 to 4 weeks, which is perhaps a Trump trade, but also perhaps a renewal of inflation trade. It's tough to say, probably both, but we believe the former, that will fade. And that the stock market investors are not looking at the spike in MOVE and saying, it's time for me to sell because this is going to damage market makers 6 months from now, 12 months from now. Those investors are buying stocks. You're at an all-time high in stocks. So that itself is a signal. Now let's talk about Bitcoin. Bitcoin is consolidating between 50 and 70K, but Bitcoin will have periodic breakdowns of correlation with stocks, and then it will renew. Well, if it has a, right now Bitcoin's correlation with stocks is still fairly strong. But on a short-term basis, obviously stocks are making an all-time high and Bitcoin isn't. We believe that what is happening in the stock market due to the forward-looking nature of investors will contribute to a supportive Bitcoin price on whatever Bitcoin's time horizon is. So Bitcoin has its own buyers and sellers. And it has its own sellers that are coming in and hitting the market in the 60s. And it's not even, it was the 70s earlier in the year, but it's not even the 70s anymore. It's back into the 60s. But guess what? The buyers are supporting. Shout out to the 58K gang who buys it every time there. And it's a meme because it's a retail expression of Bitcoin support, but it means a lot because it represents buyer behavior in Bitcoin. There are buyers. The 58K meme is an actual buyer behavior that is represented more broadly in the price. So it all comes down to the price. Bitcoin between 50 and 70 is saying things are good, but not yet ready for momentum. And that is a very plain narrative that you can take. Stocks up is a positive for Bitcoin at the margin. And our liquidity index, we will be watching it every step of the way to see where bond volatility goes and where the banking system goes. We do believe that it will be growing next year for a variety of reasons, but monetary and fiscal reasons both we believe will be present. Now, I promised you we would get into the risks to my own recessionary outlook. And I don't even want to say recessionary outlook, just my outlook that the lagged effect of monetary policy will cause enough problems in the housing sector by themselves to warrant a broader slowdown in the economy, a wave of unemployment that slows the consumer and ends up triggering a fiscal package. So that's my base case. What is the risk to it? The risk to it is that you get such a reduction in interest rates that it brings back a whole wave of animal spirits. That's that soft landing that we're talking about and that the Fed is targeting, and that the housing sector is basically saved by lower rates. Or, of course, some other external factor that we can't necessarily see. And so that's the biggest risk to the outlook, is that the lagged slowdown never comes because rates go low fast enough. So when we talk about the dollar danger, it's really this idea that higher interest rates and the higher dollar are restrictive on world economic growth. They're not going to make money creation more likely. They're going to make money creation less likely. And so unless you have a drastic cut in interest rates, which will cut the value of the dollar, you don't have that marginal boost that would be necessary to counteract what I believe are the lagged effects of the higher interest rates. So that's the risk to my outlook. And you guys know, price is truth. So if tens are at 4.5% after the election, we will have another chat. Thanks for sticking with us today. Please make sure to subscribe. thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe to our free research publication. Please consider becoming a TBL Pro so that you can follow our TBL Liquidity Index. And make sure that you follow us on YouTube, subscribe on those audio platforms, and we'll catch you guys next time.